Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags and I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers, leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Wednesday, the 14th of August, coming up on the program. Now that the Johannesburg mayor has resigned, will the municipal chaos stop? Making science work in an inequitable society, why our television set size preference is changing, and online sales have attracted the greatest number of customer complaints for a fourth consecutive year. Well, it's been in the offing for ages, and finally the Johannesburg mayor, Kabelo Gwamanda, has resigned. The question, of course, is when he does vacate his parking bay, what does he leave in his wake? Commentator Tokozani Chilenga Butau from the Department of Political Studies at the University of the Witwatersrand leads our show today. And firstly then, welcome, and what does the resignation signify about the stability of the political landscape in the metro?
Firstly, there's been a lot of activity around Johannesburg as a metropolitan in terms of leadership. And so the resignation of the mayor, I think he is the ninth mayor to resign in the past 8 years, shows that, you know, the flurry around leadership positions in this metropolitan continues, and it signals more instability, not less, regardless of what some political parties are trying to signal through the election of the next mayor. On the other hand, the resignation of this mayor in particular signals that residents, but also political parties in this metropolitan, are not happy with a mayor who appears to be placeholding for dominant political parties who cannot decide who the next mayor should be. We know that this mayor is elected from a party that didn't necessarily receive a high percentage of votes in the local government elections, but also comes after a, let's say, minority party leader from the same political party. And so it didn't appear as though this mayor was strong enough to hold this position or experienced enough to hold this position, and that was very worrying. So it's a bittersweet moment.
And that, of course, has had an impact on governance, administrative continuity, but more importantly, the ability to address critical issues like service delivery, infrastructure development, and even public safety.
Most definitely. We know that every mayor comes in with a team of people who are able to gather around them and assist them with administrative issues and governance issues, but also the unexpected things that happen with regards to service delivery and infrastructure. And what we saw with Kabelo Gwamanda is that, unfortunately, there were many things that took place in Johannesburg under his leadership that he just didn't appear able to deal with. So, for instance, the Lillian Ngoyi Street explosion. He appeared quite speechless and not knowing where to turn, in order to reassure residents that the street explosion would be investigated and would be resolved in a good amount of time. And what happened is that the MMCs around him then had to step in. The premier of the province had to step in and almost speak on his behalf. And that really not only led to a lack of trust in his leadership, but also then signaled that he probably isn't able to assemble a strong team of people around him who could advise on these issues of administration and governance.
And when you have this kind of inefficiency or even ineptitude, this doesn't only have an impact on the city of Johannesburg, because given the size and the influence of the metro, it has an impact on the country.
It really does. I mean, Johannesburg is one of the largest metropolitans in the country, but also, you know, on the continent. And so when you have someone who is either inexperienced or not proactive enough, it shows that there are a lot of vulnerabilities in governance that we might take for granted, even if we disagree with who the mayor is at the time, whether they're from a political party that we disagree with. But what we don't want is a leader who, unfortunately, doesn't have the requisite skills, doesn't have the requisite experience. And that shows a far deeper problem within political parties who cannot reach a consensus on who the mayor should be.
All right, so in an ideal world, and we know that that doesn't exist in the realm of politics, but let's speculate if we can. What does the city need in terms of governance and continuity?
In terms of governance and continuity, firstly, we need a leader who has experience of working within Johannesburg Metropolitan. And for anyone who, you know, does not vote for any of the dominant political parties, unfortunately, that means that it's going to have to be someone who comes from either the ANC or the DA, possibly the EFF, who have led the city before. So that will lead to some sort of continuity in terms of experience. But what we also need is a leader who is open to working with other political parties during this time. Because as we know, local government has been touched by and led through coalition governments even prior to the 2024 general election. And so we need a leader who is open to working with other political parties. But finally, we need a leader who is able to establish themselves and some sort of track record, not for their political party, but for Johannesburg as a metropolitan city. So making sure that the plans that are implemented are sustainable, making sure that they're not putting the party ahead of the needs of the city, different needs in different areas of the city.
And in that respect, do you think any early lessons might be learnt from the strategic direction from the national or the government of national unity, the national setup now?
Yes, most definitely. I mean, at the national level, some of us did anticipate that there would be some sort of coalition or government of national unity. We just didn't know whether national leaders and political parties had the political maturity to see that through. And so the lesson there is that whether you win or lose with 30%, 40%, 20%, however many seats you need in council, you also need to have the political maturity to work with other political parties, not just to get you over the line in terms of the seats that you need for election, but for continuing governance and for representation of everyone who voted, regardless of whether they voted for your political party.
I've been talking to Thokozani Chilenga-Butau from the Department of Political Studies at the University of the Witwatersrand here in Johannesburg. Thokozani, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, let me pivot now from politics to purchase. And online sales have attracted the greatest number of customer complaints for a fourth consecutive year, according to a new report from the Consumer Goods and Services Ombud. Leah Subrati says the majority of complaints concerned items ordered online not being delivered on time, buyers receiving defective goods, and purchases not aligning with buyer expectation. He joins me now. And firstly then, which sectors have you identified as having the most customer complaints, and what steps are being taken to address the issues?
In terms of the sectors, and this is something that takes a little bit of understanding to actually read the stats correctly. So what we find is that a lot of consumers are transacting online. In terms of the CGSO and Consumer Goods and Services Ombud, and what we see, consumers are transacting a lot online. But how does this then land as a complaint at our office? And this is where an example would be key. A consumer can transact online, but the complaint will not be relating directly to that online transaction. And this is where the stats differ in some respects. So, for example, a consumer buying a kettle or a TV online may be dissatisfied with the quality of the product and will log that complaint as such, as a defective product, as opposed to having the disgruntledness with that particular online retailer. So to answer your question, the sectors that we're seeing that is bringing a lot of the complaints in is the online retail space, but the nature and the type of complaint differs depending on what the consumer's complaint is actually about, if I'm making sense.
You're making perfect sense, Lee. What do we mean by purchases not aligning with buyers' expectation? Is it we see something in the picture and when we open the box, we are mightily disappointed?
Yeah, so when it comes to online transactions, we have the Electronic Communications Act, which is quite clear. Any online retailer needs to reflect the goods as to what the goods, what can you expect as a customer when I purchase those goods in terms of quantity, in terms of what the picture says it to be, obviously together with the terms and conditions. And it is quite clear that they have to be quite descriptive. And we have quite good legislation when it comes to online transactions in the sense that a customer transacting online can return goods with no questions asked within 7 days from date of purchase if they purchase those goods online. Now, as an ombud, what do we do in this process? If a customer, for example, sees a picture of what they expect and the goods that are received do not meet any sort of expectations of what they saw online, they have the full right to return those goods and the costing depending on who is at fault here. But as the ombud, we ensure that as a customer, you exercise those rights. And if you're not happy with those goods, and if the supplier is failing to actually accept the return, that's where we get involved and we start the conversation with the hope that it can be resolved for you getting your money back and the goods being returned to that supplier.
Would I be correct in saying that your job has become more difficult in recent years when it comes to managing complaints related to products purchased from international online vendors? And I don't need to tell you, Lee, we're seeing more and more of that.
Yes, I mean, it's been quite prevalent. I mean, if you look at the recent media reports, the articles, there is quite a big debate happening relating to, and these are defined in our transactions. Now, as the ombud, remember, we are an ombud that's accredited by statute, the Consumer Protection Act. And because we operate within the borders of South Africa, our right and our reach is very limited. However, attempts are continuously being made with regulators, with stakeholders to look at, even though goods come in from cross-border sort of institutions or companies, how do we protect the consumer who's receiving the goods here in South Africa? And how can we extend the rights that the CPA gives to consumers who transact within the borders of South Africa?
All right, let's assume then that I've made the purchase, I open it, and my kettle doesn't look like anything that I wanted. I approach you. How does the ombud go about resolving this conflict?
That's perfect. So like with anything, the consumer has to first give the supplier an opportunity to respond, to correct the complaint, you know. And if that supplier does not assist the consumer to the satisfaction of that consumer within 15 business days, the consumer can immediately log the complaint with the office of the ombud, and we have an expected turnaround time of 60 business days. But we try, if you see from my annual report, we have a current average of 41 days. So we try our best to resolve the complaint as soon as possible. And now we have an application. We have an online www.cgso.org.za. And we have a call share number that consumers can call in, and we will get involved in the process and try to speedily resolve the complaint to the benefit of both.
And when you say get involved, what do you actually do?
Remember, the whole purpose of what we do is to get the parties to speak. So we use methods of mediation. It's very important to note that our outcomes are not binding. They're not binding rulings. They're not an order of court. All that they are to do is to get the supplier and the consumer to communicate and to ensure that, number one, that the Consumer Protection Act is promoted and is applied. And from there, to look at ways of resolving the complaint. So all that we are is that we are facilitator of the alternative dispute resolution process, which comes with its benefits of parties sometimes discussing, listen, these are the options we can propose to the customer to make them happy and to resolve the complaint. Ideally, we look at future relationship between the supplier and the consumer, because in an economy that you want to be sustainable, we have to try and repair the relationship as best as we can.
And if your mediation is unsuccessful, what happens then?
then at that point, the consumer can approach the National Consumer Commission. Remember, we as the Ombud, we report to the National Consumer Commission under the umbrella of the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition. So the escalation procedures are there. What we are meant to do is to try and resolve it at first, sort of first bite at the apple, so to speak, so that one saves time, one saves costs, because a lot of consumers don't have the means of going the full legal route.
Are you finding that as online shopping becomes more prevalent and there is an increase in complaints, the big online stores themselves are starting to play ball?
Yeah, I mean, we engage with a lot of local retailers when it comes to online retailers. And what we can find, especially with things like third-party sellers, you know, marketplace sort of places and stuff where third parties are able to market their goods. What we find is that because e-commerce is becoming so prevalent, like you mentioned, that providers, in order for them to create sustainable businesses, they have to bring their lines and their practical application of their processes in line with the CPA. Because no one wants to be found wanting of the law, wanting of the CPA. It's not good for business. But on a positive note, we do find that local retailers are applying those concepts. And also now, with the inclusion of other global players now in the local market, it drives the economy, it drives competition. At the same time, with competition comes the need for you to be compliant. And I mean, the Ombud statistics speaks for that, and it assists, you know, in companies just providing that overall protection for consumers.
You spoke about the current consumer protection laws. Do you believe they're adequate, or are there gaps that need to be addressed?
Like with any legislation, over time, your customer, your supplier base changes, the type of transactions, the type of economy we see, and, you know, especially with bigger players in the market. So the Consumer Protection Act, and I'll say this again, we have one of the best pieces of legislation in the world. But then the question that then asks, how do we now need to adapt that legislation to cater for the current frustrations and gaps that we see? And I think what we have going for us is that every 5 years, our government has the opportunity to relook at these laws to see how can we better it. And it's institutions like ombuds and regulators and consumer bodies that assist to expose these gaps so that we can move towards amending these laws to cover those areas that are uncovered.
Yeah, well, good to see that the consumer is protected. Lee Subrathi, thank you very much indeed. Consumer Goods and Services Ombud. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And just ahead on the program, the unintended consequences of the streaming revolution. But before that, the world is plagued with numerous challenges, including climate change, disease, poverty and malnutrition, with the negative impacts most felt in developing economies. So in that respect, are we embracing science and technology sufficiently as a solution? Dr. Clarieta Chagwisa is a senior postdoctoral research fellow at Future Africa at the University of Pretoria and joins me on the program now. And firstly then, why do you believe inequality remains so persistent in spite of some economic growth in developing countries?
Oh, the main reason is because inequality is complex and political in nature. So by the fact that we are experiencing economic growth, it doesn't mean that it's, you know, being experienced by everybody in the society. This is because, you know, the gains from economic growth are not being distributed fairly across all the segments. There are people who are privileged. So those people, obviously, they will have, you know, the upper hand. They will keep, you know, progressing, yet the disadvantaged will keep on the bottom always.
You also make a very interesting point about the impact of technological advancement and the accessibility and why this is of concern regarding rural and disadvantaged communities. And I guess the challenge there would be to try and bridge that gap, but not always easy to do, Doctor.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not always easy, but the point is we need, you know, to invest like our governments and also the private sector. We need to make an effort, all of us, to invest in rural areas to improve access, for example, to internet, to computers for the rural kids also, so that they can be exposed to technologies, expose them to, you know, coding and robotics, because those the kids in elite schools, they're already doing this. Of my kids, you know, in K kindergarten, they are already coding. So that's my wish, that, you know, the kids in the rural areas will also have that exposure.
How do you convince the private sector to do that, given that in most instances that particular sector acts aggressively in pursuit of its own interests?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know it's not like a walk in the park, but, you know, we can benchmark even with what is happening in other countries. I know, for instance, in Rwanda, that country, the people in that country, regardless of being the government or the private sector, they are all pulling together. You know, because we're working towards the same goal of leaving no one behind. So if we can benchmark, you know, we can also like take lessons from those countries, then I think we'll be able to do this as a country.
One of the key questions that you ask, Dr. Chagwisa, is how science and innovation can be better integrated into policy making to reduce inequality. Tease your thinking out for me in that respect. What's the premise that you're putting forward and how do you do that?
Yeah, okay, the point that I was trying to put across is, you know, through science, we can develop, you know, technologies, we can develop innovations that can boost economic growth. But it's pointless if experience economic growth and then the previously disadvantaged, they keep on at the bottom. You know, they keep staying at the bottom. So I'm saying, like, with science, then, you know, anchored by economic, social, and political policies. So it's the issue of policy and also the governance structure.
Would you agree with me that often science and technology is compartmentalized by government and it's not something that is pulled or threaded through all policy making? If you agree with that assertion, how do you make sure that that approach is changed to make all of this more all-encompassing?
Yeah, because there's also like an issue of even the governments, they don't believe even in science outcomes, the science products. So there is like lack of trust in science. So that's what we are trying to do. You know, I'm working on a certain project as well here at Future Africa as part of my job. We are trying to improve the voice of African scientists. And these are the other issues that we are trying to do, to make, you know, the governments understand the importance of science. So we are trying to find out if it's important for us to establish a pan-African science forum so that we can put together scientists across Africa, even the other Africans in the diaspora, so that we work together towards achieving growth and equity.
I'm very interested to know why you say there is a lack of trust in science.
Yeah, because some of the technologies and innovations that are being produced, they are not, you know, the uptake is a bit low. And also the investment in research and development. Recently, I was writing an empirical paper on research and development in economic growth. So I was also using governance as the mitigating factor. So we realized that, you know, the governments in Africa, they are not putting much money, or they're not spending more towards research and development. So for me, that shows it's not something, you know, research and development is not something they value, or maybe I don't understand, because research and development, that's where we get the technologies and innovations that can boost economic growth, but still the investment is still very low. South Africa is actually the highest in Africa as far as spending towards R&D is concerned, but still, it's still very low. I think now it's sitting at 0.6.
Well, you certainly have thrown down the gauntlet as far as the private sector is concerned, as well as governments. Dr. Clarieta Chagwisa, Senior Postdoctoral Research Fellow at Future Africa at the University of Pretoria, thank you very much for joining me today. I do appreciate it.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Our final guest on the program suggests that an unintended consequence of the streaming revolution can be witnessed in living rooms right around the world. As more screen entertainment moves out of cinemas and into homes, consumers are investing more and more in big screens. Arthur Goldstuck from the research agency Worldwide Works is with us now. And Arthur, why do you believe this revolution then has led to the increased investment?
The primary reason for people wanting bigger screens is because they are watching more content and in particular more entertainment on their screens. So in the past, when we were stuck to what they call linear TV, i.e. the likes of SABC TV, ETV and the like, you tended to have a hit and miss approach to whether you're watching news, variety shows or movies. But now it's moving heavily towards movies with a streaming revolution and people embracing the likes of Netflix and Showmax. And the result of that is that the entertainment becomes a lot more immersive, and therefore the appeal of big screen TVs increases exponentially. Well, increases certainly in line with the size of the screens.
And Arthur, the primary consumers then driving this trend towards bigger home screens, would it be upper echelons?
It's across the board. What you will see in the upper income segments is that they're going for bigger TVs. So I had a fascinating chat with the MD of Sony for Middle East and Africa, and he was saying that in the United Arab Emirates, for example, the average screen size is now 75 to 85 inches, and that's because people entertain a lot at home and they want others to see what they have, what they've invested in, what they are capable of buying. In South Africa, it's still not at that level, but people still want to enjoy the content they're getting. So depending on the income level of the person or the household, you'll have a bigger or a smaller screen. And we are tending towards 65-inch screens in upper-income homes, but it's still around 50 to 55-inch as the aspirational screen, you could say, in middle to lower income homes. And there you can compare us to a market like Nigeria, for example, where Sony tells us that it's still around 55 inches as the typical screen size.
What exactly is this immersive experience that you're talking about?
We're talking about people getting more involved in the content. It's not immersive as in what they might have spoken about 10 years ago when 3D TVs came along and the manufacturers were all saying this is far more of an immersive experience. In fact, it was a horrible experience watching 3D TV. Indeed, now immersiveness refers more to getting involved and engaged with the content. With better visuals, high-definition video, for example, and also high-definition audio, for that matter, makes you feel also more engaged with the content. But mostly it's the phenomenon of binge-watching that has come along with streaming TV or streaming video, and people really becoming engaged with the series and with the characters in that series and feeling they're part of that world.
And this is really putting cinema on the back foot, isn't it?
Very much so. Cinema and traditional TV is suffering as a result. So we're seeing Sam Kinicord trying some fairly innovative approaches to bringing people back to the movies. But the reality is it's only the blockbuster shows that will bring them back. The current Deadpool and Wolverine movie, for example, will attract people back to the cinemas. But there's only so many of those kind of shows you can have. Whereas on streaming video, there's almost infinite content in terms of what someone's capable of watching as a household or as an individual.
And Arthur, opportunities for innovation in home entertainment as this trend continues, I presume the goalposts are being moved all the time.
Very much so. And that comes both with the size and format of the screens. And we had for a while curved screens, for example, which were popular. But people realized they didn't get too much benefit out of this screen being curved. But what we are seeing is thinner and thinner screens and thinner bezels, in other words, the edge around the screen, so that the screen becomes almost something that you can hang on a wall. It's like a painting, and it's got the same weight as a lightweight painting anyway. So that's one area. Sound bars are becoming a big thing as well to improve the sound experience. And you're seeing all the audio equipment manufacturers and the TV manufacturers investing heavily in sound bars. And then you have the likes of Sonos, for example, creating multiple speaker factors that you can build around your home entertainment system to turn it, again, to use that word, into a truly immersive experience.
So where does this leave the small screen? Because there was a time not too long ago where we were consuming an enormous amount of video content, either on our cell phones or on our tablets.
In fact, that is still a very big part of viewing. A high proportion of South Africans say that they are consuming content on their smartphones. And that's because the screens of smartphones are also getting bigger, not on the same level as the TV screens. But if you consider that when Samsung first came out with a Note, which was seen as a large screen smartphone, it was a 5.2-inch screen. And they were mocked by the Apple users who said, how are you going to get your hands around a screen that size? That's when Apple phones were still 4.5 inches. Today, the standard size is 6.5 to 6.8 inches screen. And Apple is part of that revolution as well. So the smartphone becomes also a vehicle for watching streaming content.
And as this big screen trend continues, what impacts is it going to have on price?
The beauty of price with TVs is as the more advanced TVs and the bigger TVs become more mainstream and become more mass marketed, prices come down as well. So a TV that you would have paid 20,000 rand for 5 years ago would now be under 10,000 rand. And the same is going to happen with the big screen TVs, probably not coming down to as low as the 28-inch flat screen TVs, which you can now get for under 3,000 rand. It's unlikely we'll see the large screen TVs come to that level. But if you think that a 65 to 85-inch screen 5 years to 10 years ago would have been seen as something only the super wealthy could afford, and they're now becoming commonplace in your electronic stores, it's clear that they'll become affordable to certainly anyone in the middle income ranges and eventually even in low income households.
Arthur Goldstuck from the research company Worldwide Works, thank you very much indeed. And interestingly, supporting Arthur's argument on our last online poll and ahead of the interview, I asked you about the changing habits of television set purchase. I asked if you've switched to a big screen TV, if it's too expensive, or if size doesn't matter to you. Most of our audience say they have traded up. Today, our lead story, Johannesburg's mayor quits. My question to you, things will change now, more musical chairs, or stand by for more municipal chaos. If you have a view on that, I invite you to go to either our X or LinkedIn page. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.